This is Dissecting Dragons, a speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, I'm the bad guy. Or am I? Morally grey characters in speculative fiction.
And once again, Jules, I have to applaud the way that you title these things. Like, it's a genuine point that you're putting across. You yourself.
Have you just worked out that I've been using this podcast to subliminally message people across the world? Everyone is now programmed and ready for deployment. All I need is my code word.
What's the code word?
I can't tell you. What I'll do is I'll drop it in a future episode and then we will watch the world burn together.
Okay, I'm looking forward to it.
Okay, for any government agencies who happen to just randomly be listening to this podcast, that was obviously a joke. I don't have that kind of power.
And if she did, it's too late.
I've just read way too much dystopian fiction about mad female scientists. That's clearly what it is. Right. Let's try and get on the subject of what we're talking about this week.
Yeah, though weirdly enough, the way you were just talking does make you sound like a very grey character.
It does. So, why this topic? It's no secret that I love a morally ambiguous character and that I will bond spiritually with the morally dubious characters in books that I love. I'm pretty sure we've brought that up before. So from my perspective, it's a case of, oh, we haven't really explored this topic in depth. I'd love to look at it a bit more closely.
Yeah. I feel like you especially bond towards morally grey characters who are mentals.
Yeah, I mean, that is a thing, and obviously we'll go into it in a bit more detail later, but the whole mentor trope, they do tend to be morally grey. I mean, you take someone like Dumbledore, for example. Ultimately, yes, he's on the side of the angels, but technically he's quite morally dubious, the things he's willing to do in order to serve his own agenda. So, yeah. Again, we'll look at all these things a bit later, but literally this one is just a case of, oh, I'm interested in this topic, not a case of, I have a massive opinion in this area and I'm going to force you all to listen to it. So that should make a lovely change for everyone.
Be warned though, Jules will have an opinion, even if she's not aware of it yet.
Okay. I'm sorry.
There is nothing wrong with it. I think your opinions, and occasionally mine, are the reason that our listeners come back, so...
Well, it's definitely not for the coffee, put it that way.
Yeah, I make a shit cup of coffee. Anyway,
Yes.
Right, so, I guess we should probably start with a very simple look at what we actually mean by morally grey characters. What does being morally grey actually entitle?
Definitely. I suppose the broadest definition is that morally grey characters are characters who have both good and bad qualities, who make good and bad decisions, and they make them for good and bad motivations. So they can be real sit-on-the-fence type characters. And I know this is not the same as saying giving your character a flaw, which they either have to get round or that will actually conquer them in the end, depending on where your story's going. This is a case of, this is someone who could potentially go in either direction, and it's fine. They're very much... their only real allegiance ultimately is to themselves and their own agendas, so their idea of what is right may not be your idea of what is right, or the main character's idea of what is right.
Yes. They might be described by other characters as a notorious dick, for instance.
Yeah, they can be. Or it can be a case of, well, this is the person that we need help from, because this is the person who knows and who has the skills, because again, quite often they get tied up with the whole mentor character trope.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you're wary of approaching this person.
Yeah.
Because you know damn well that their help is going to cost you in some form. So, yeah, it's a very distinct form of character. It's not the same as saying, well, you've got a hero and they've got a massive flaw whereby they're quite proud of themselves and to the point where they can be quite arrogant. So it's not having a flaw that they have to get round or having a natural hubris. It is a case of, for their own reasons, which sometimes appear spurious to the reader, that they will follow their own agenda.
Yeah. And weirdly enough, it's a big archetype. The morally grey character is one that has appeared throughout history and is actually a very important part of a lot of pantheons, a lot of cultures. And I think very often the morally grey character is erased from our understanding that the morally grey character, I'm going to use he here, but it obviously doesn't have to be a he, that he was at one point a foundation stone, a major archetype in most of our cultural stories. And he's kind of been wiped out a little bit in the West and then sort of reintroduced through fiction.
Yeah, I mean, another character, a trope that, or archetype's a better word probably, that the morally grey character often bonds with is the trickster.
Yeah.
And you know, as much as you love a good trickster, they're tricksters for a reason. They're not trustworthy.
Yeah.
And if you look at myths and legends and things, they help things move along. They are agents of change. That change isn't always a good thing, or that change isn't always a good thing for the people involved immediately at the time.
Yeah.
And I think you can say that about morally grey characters and plots as well. But obviously, we'll go into that in a bit later.
Yeah.
So, I think there are three sort of distinct types of morally grey character, and where you know basically it is very much open to your personal and reader interpretation as to what group a character falls in or whether you think that's a morally grey character at all.
Yeah.
So as we've said, the broadest one is a character that has both good and bad qualities and literally follows their own agenda. And the thing is with that one is, for me, this isn't always necessarily a morally grey character. This is someone who can be just sort of working through some shit, or, you know, who could be eminently corruptible, depending on how the story goes.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say they're necessarily morally grey in the traditional sense, but I understand why other people say, no, this is a morally grey character. They're not definitely good and they're not definitely bad.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm just trying to think of an example of of someone who's like that, who you could argue is either morally grey or who isn't.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't explain that very well. Let's have an example of an archetype. So basically, someone who does bad things, but their underlying motivations are good or at least understandable. So Robin Hood, for example.
Yes.
He steals, which is bad. We all acknowledge that stealing is bad, hopefully. But he steals from the rich to give to the poor, according to legend. So, you know, his motivations are at least understandable, unless you're one of the barons he's stealing from, in which case, you know, you hate him like fire.
Yeah. And of course, the thing with Robin Hood, actually, I think in particular, is that obviously because he's such an enigmatic character and such a universal character, he can shift between being more morally ambiguous to less morally ambiguous, and obviously it's all about how he's ultimately going to be painted. You know, there are some versions where he won't steal from rich people, he won't steal from people who have something if they're honest with him.
Yeah, absolutely.
And or he only steals from the corrupt. You know, particularly one of the things was he was this big folklore hero, and then what happened was the aristocracy, they really liked him, they couldn't get rid of him, so they made him part of the aristocracy as well. So that it's not that the aristocracy are inherently evil and need to be stolen from, it's that the corrupt aristocracy need to be taken care of, basically. I can understand the argument about whether Robin Hood is morally grey or not. Because I think also, once again, that joke I made right at the beginning is that a lot of people think of morally grey characters as assholes. And inherently, they don't have to be assholes.
No, they really don't. Okay, another category is... Well, let's say the second category of morally grey characters are those who could jump in either direction. And really, it can depend on their whim at the time. It can depend what demon moves them, as it were. Sometimes it can be a case of they just like to stir the pot and see what reactions they get. And these are the ones who genuinely only own allegiance to themselves. They kind of live for the moment and for the mischief. And a good example is obviously Loki, but obviously all the other sort of messenger god archetypes also fit into this role.
I mean, Hermes could probably fit into that role as well. just stir the pot a little bit. Dionysus as well, I think, in some respect.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, in a lot of ways, they seem to be... if we're talking gods and mythology, they tend to be less powered in the same way as, say, some of the big, more titanic type gods. But they can cause a sort of change that is disproportionate to their ability. And it's not always good for the people who are involved. But once you see, you know, you read further on into the lore or whatever, and you kind of see it was necessary.
Yeah.
It's just sometimes it was also really... You know, sometimes it's motivated by cruelty. It's that line from, I can't remember which Batman film it is, but some men just like to see the world burn. Sometimes these guys are in that kind of mood.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting because in some ways that these morally grey characters, you first have got to kind of touch on the idea of what a moral is. What is a moral? And a moral is based on something that's incredibly human. You know, morals are changeable. They always have been. Our morals have changed according to our society, according to our circumstances. And, you know, depending on what's available to us, what our lives are like, you know, the moral of never steal might change to you can steal to survive, as long as you're only doing it to survive, or you can steal from the corrupt who are stealing from you, or, you know, you can kill the man who is trying to murder all of your friends, or, you know, something like that, in that, you know, depending on what the circumstances are.
Or the Romany tradition of living lightly on the land, whereby if it's not missed, therefore it's not really stolen, because nobody missed it, therefore nobody really owned it.
So,
which is highly subject to interpretation.
You know, so that, you know, there's lots of kind of ways of looking at this. But the point is that morals are not set in stone, no matter what people try to say, you know. And there's a joke there about the Ten Commandments. But morality does change and has changed. We do tend to have some relatively universal ideas, but even those can kind of shift and budge, you know. Don't kill, okay, but if you're at war with someone, apparently then it's fine, you know. So morals do shift. And there's this sense with some of these archetypal kind of pantheon-esque grey characters that they are amoral not because they're evil inherently, but because they are above these human concepts. They are part of something which is not human. So Loki, for instance, is chaos personified. And chaos is both a good and a bad thing in the natural world. You know, when you have a volcano erupt, lots of things die. And yet then life will flourish from it. You know, it's ultimately this sense of change. So you can have these amoral characters who are amoral not because, again, as I said, they're evil, but because they are actually detached from these human moralities and instead engaged with something beyond that, something totally natural or totally philosophical, you know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely. And obviously from our perspective, it looks like whim. And
yeah.
And there can be a certain amount of whim with people like Loki.
Yes.
But they, you know, obviously they serve the agents of chaos and change, which are also necessary, as you said.
Yeah.
Okay, the third type in narrative terms is the morally grey character who their desires, their goals and motivations might temporarily align with that of the main characters. But if they're ever put in a position whereby they must choose between pursuing their own agenda and assisting the main character, chances are they're going to choose themselves. So they're not bad per se, but they're also kind of like, I haven't sworn myself to this quest. This is a case of, at the moment, it's mutually convenient for us to go in this direction, but ultimately, it's me. I'm out for me,
yeah.
Because, you know, I'm the only person I know who looks out for myself, and I'm okay with that.
Yeah. It's the enemy of my enemy kind of thing in some respects.
Yeah, kind of. You know, and there might even be genuine friendship and affection there, but ultimately when it comes down to it, it's kind of like, nope, this is a morally grey character who's going to make the decision, not because it's right. You know how sometimes you see characters and they're like, oh, I should do this, and I know it's the sensible thing to do, but the right decision to do is the thing that is actually going to fuck everything up. And they do make the right decision and you get really frustrated with them. The morally grey character doesn't do that. They do the sensible decision,
yeah.
Even when it's really shit.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, examples of that, Yennefer of Vengerberg from the Witcher series.
Yeah, absolutely. Yennefer is out for number one.
Very much so. And yeah, there are times when her goals and desires align with other people's temporarily, but ultimately she will pick herself. She's on her side.
Yeah.
Well, certainly that's how it starts for her.
Sorry.
I'm trying to think, does it actually improve a lot? I'm not sure because it's been a long time since I read the books. I look forward to finding out again.
Yeah, I won't say anything, but... but yeah, you're absolutely right. And the interesting thing is that there's an empowerment that comes to these morally grey characters. And we're kind of trained to see them as selfish or bad because selfishness is seen as something which is inherently bad. But I would argue that actually it's a lot more complicated than that. It's a lot more complicated than that. And weirdly enough, if you have a morally grey character who's doing everything they can in order to protect something like their child or, you know, their family or something like that, suddenly we're all like, yeah, but it's okay then. And I'm like, it's still ultimately a selfish thing, isn't it? But for some reason,
yeah.
The moment it extends beyond one person, we seem to be relatively okay with it, despite the fact that ultimately it's the same kettle of fish, as it were.
Well, yeah, I think I might have even seen this in a fantasy novel where by someone's child was captured by slavers and they said, well, you bring us three children and we'll give you your child back.
Yeah.
So they brought captured three other children for them, brought them along and exchanged them for one. So, you know, it's kind of like, yeah, you can understand why you might do that for your own child, but what they've done is not right.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But yet we tend to be more forgiving about it. It's like, oh, but it's for, you know, it's for someone else. No, it's not for someone else. It's for yourself because you can't bear the idea of living without that person, or you can't bear the idea of that person not suffering. Ultimately, everything we do is selfish if you're going to play by that law of, oh, well, if you're doing it for you, then it's inherently selfish. I don't know. Doing anything is inherently selfish, really.
Yeah, I mean, you can take it to the nth degree and say, well, by standing here, I'm denying this patch of grass sunlight, or by taking a breath, I'm taking oxygen from somebody else kind of thing.
Yeah.
At some point, you have to say, actually, I do have the right to exist, and that means sometimes that it's going to be shit for somebody else.
Yeah. And I think with the morally grey characters, that something that you tend to typically get with a morally grey character, as Jules has already kind of noted, is that they will be acting on their behalf because no one else is.
Yeah.
So they will tend to have relatively sad pasts. They will tend to be ostracized. They will tend to be, bullied or, even threatened. Their lives might be threatened. And weirdly enough, it makes me think about Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice. stick with me.
No, I'm with you. I think I know where you're going, but please carry on.
That incredibly, that incredibly moving monologue of if you stab us, do we not bleed? If you tickle us, do we not laugh? And I can't remember his name. What's his name?
Shylock,
that's it. So this is a Jewish man who, during the Shakespearean times, the Jewish people, no one, as far as they were concerned, and obviously they just hadn't realised it, had ever actually met a Jewish person. Jewish people were kind of personified as these very devil-esque creatures, I would even say. And so Shakespeare was actually quite revolutionary by having this speech that actually said, well, no, you have a character who's turning around and saying, I'm a human being, the same as you. And if I act badly, it's because you have taught me to act badly, and I will, I will learn from example. And Shylock is not a good character. But everything he does is actually kind of understandable. You have this guy who has been, really making Shylock's life incredibly difficult and has then come to Shylock, to get money. And he says, well, I'll take a pound of your flesh instead when it doesn't pay back. And everyone's like, but you're not actually going to do that. And he's like, yeah, actually, I am. And here's why. It's an incredibly powerful moment, I think.
Yeah, it is really interesting. Shylock has definitely started swerving towards the bad end of the morally grey spectrum.
Yeah.
but
it's, I think that Shakespeare actually really touched on something amazing there, which is that Shylock has done that, but he's doing it by example. He's kind of been pushed into it because his own self-interest, his basic needs have not been met. And he's in an incredibly unjust world. So, yeah, he's going to react unkindly to it. He is going to be looking out for himself and his own interests because literally nobody else is.
I'm not sure whether I can kind of see why you make the connection. I'm not sure I'd really put him as morally grey, but I kind of see what you mean.
Well, no, I think he's not really morally grey anymore. But there's this sense that it's that speech which offers this kind of glimmer into the fact that he kind of started out maybe that way and that there has been this descent, as it were.
Yeah. No, I completely follow that, and we'll end up going off on a tangent, but I think I've got an intrinsic sort of dislike of this character became like this, or this person became like this because they were treated badly, even though that can happen in real life. My thing ultimately is that, yes, you've been treated badly, and you know what, you get to kind of drop a few clangers, but then after that you are entirely responsible for everything you do.
Yeah. Oh no, don't get me wrong, I'm not excusing what he's doing. I'm just saying that this is kind of an example of how it can sort of be personified and how it could descend into it. Again, I'm not saying Shylock's a good guy, or that I'd want to have dinner with
him. I wasn't saying that at all. I've got a lot of sympathy for Shylock because he's an oppressed person who has turned savage, and that is a perfectly understandable thing. I'm just not entirely sure it quite fits the narrative of a morally grey character, but it is a good illustration of the whole, as you say, sometimes these characters start off as being isolated, which is why they're then out for themselves within a narrative.
Yeah.
Let's look at some pros and cons of morally grey characters. Let's start with pros. The reason that you might want to have that sort of character within a story, or you might enjoy it as a reader. Mm-hmm. They're believable if they're done correctly. In fact, any character that's done correctly should be believable, ideally. But they're believable on the level that most of us aren't really good or bad. We're somewhere in between, and we choose which direction to sort of aim ourselves in. Thereby, if you have a really, really good character or a really, really bad character, sometimes they're harder to identify with. Whereas a morally grey character is kind of like, even when they're doing things you don't approve of, or things you think, well, I wouldn't like stress myself to go after doing that. you kind of identify with them more easily, I think.
Yeah, I think
because
you're right.
Because of that ambiguity.
Yeah, I actually think you're right. and I think it's also because you're even more likely to identify with them because there has been this very forced narrative of the goody good 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 guy and the baddie baddie bad bad guy.
Yeah, I think a lot of that sort of comes from, because we never used to really have that. That I think that was sort of the late Victorian era all the way through to sort of the 1950s, 1960s. And on from then. And you really got it in things like, you know, the early superhero comics.
Yeah.
Even though they could be incredibly nuanced, but early Superman and things like that.
It's always the Victorians' fault, isn't it?
Well, I'm not saying it's their fault on this occasion. I'm just saying we inherited something here. But on another issue, I will talk to you about it later because it's not relevant to this podcast. But I learned something interesting. Anyway, I think that is kind of the during the war and post-war mentality, particularly the Cold War mentality of there must be a good guy and a bad guy. And if we're the good guys, they must be the bad
guys.
Exactly,
yeah.
Which we've inherited. And you can still find it now in children's literature, especially. It's changing, but you think of the older style children's literature, particularly for the younger junior fiction, there quite often isn't a lot of nuance, and that wasn't always the case. I mean, the idea of there being literature just for children is relatively recent in a lot of ways, and obviously, again, I'm blaming the Victorians, but they tidied up a lot of the fairy tales and things so that you only got the good and the bad rather than the huge chunk in between, which was kind of like, it was neither.
Yeah.
It was just kind of, this is how it was. So yeah, you do see it, you're like, oh, well, if he's the goodie, he must be the baddie kind of thing. That was very prevalent when I was growing up. I think it's changed a little bit, but I'm honestly not sure how much.
I think it has. And I think that it's also because as we try and move into a world of more tolerance, it's about understanding perspective, because we all think of ourselves as the good guy. So if someone doesn't quite agree with us, it's then very easy to project the bad guy onto them. It's similarly, if someone doesn't quite look like us, it's easy to project the bad guy onto them. So obviously, as we move away, hopefully, from those kinds of things, a lot of authors feel like they really want to introduce the idea of perspectives, in that someone can do bad things and still be a bad person, but they will have a reason for doing it. Whether that's an excusable reason or not is up to the writer, but I think that actually, yeah, just that inherent, I'm evil because I'm evil, doesn't that...
Which was never... It was never a satisfying narrative. I'm just thinking of the irritating and slightly saccharine, but that was all we had to watch, cartoons of the 80s, whereby you were watching something like He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, and at the end you'd have Prince Adam giving you the moral of the week. And it's like, so remember, kids, etc., etc. And I'm sure that sort of comes on from the 1950s Superman era of remember, kids. You know, where you had Superman kind of saying, don't talk to strangers, don't do drugs, don't drink kind of thing, don't smoke, otherwise you'll be sick just like your daddy kind of thing. And it was just the moralising. Kids don't really enjoy being moralised at any more than anyone else does. And they don't really enjoy villains who are just bad because they're bad. Because after a certain point, the child's kind of like, yeah, but why?
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. They never get anything from it. They're always foiled.
Enter the morally grey. Which is why I think for me, and this is, I mean, he's an ultimately very creepy character, but this is where Dungeon Master comes in from the Dungeons and Dragons cartoon, whereby I swear that character was morally grey. Everything he did was kind of like, if you do this, you can get home. And then he'd present them with this horrible dilemma whereby they had to stay. And each time they chose, and I'm like, you are definitely serving your own agenda there, Dungeon Master. You know? So, yeah, okay, you might be kind of more on the side of good than, say, Venger. And, you know, you can tell Venger's bad because he's got this horn out the side of his head and his flying horse has red eyes and black fur kind of thing. So he must be the bad guy. But even Venger kind of had his more nuanced moments. So it was actually a really good cartoon for the time in that perspective. So, yeah, we didn't get a lot of nuance in our 80s cartoons. I'm glad that that has changed somewhat.
I completely agree.
Okay, other pros. Absolute goodness is utterly exhausting. Yeah. And absolute villainy is kind of boring. And doesn't make sense. So going on from what we've just said about 80s cartoons.
Yeah, you want to have a bit of a gradient, to be honest.
Yeah.
I'm also going to point out, which is that obviously the absolute good and the absolute, you know, evil is just not relatable on any level, is also kind of boring and predictable. Whereas morally grey characters, even if they are morally grey on the side of good or bad, just will surprise you every now and again. There's this element of, I don't quite know what you're going to do next. And they're more often entertaining characters because of it. And that is demonstrated in, you know, the way they act, the way that they speak, the way that they engage with the rest of the world.
Yeah, definitely. The morally grey character's packaging is quite often contains one or more of the following, which is snark, irreverence, wit, a sense of whimsy, cynicism, and, you know, just generally a sense of being slightly more in the know than the rest. I think one of the more satisfying sort of morally grey character arcs is when you've got a character like that and they're won over to the side of the heroes, if you like, sort of in spite of themselves. Maybe because they can see, yeah, there's a lot of sense in what they're doing. I don't really buy into the cause and the idealism.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I can see this is a better choice.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's quite a satisfying one.
I agree. I feel kind of like Han Solo sort of started out in the morally grey.
Yeah, because at best they are chaotic good. Han Solo is chaotic good.
Yeah.
Very much so. I love it when people say, oh, yeah, good guys like Han Solo. I'm like, yeah, should we talk about the cantina? You know, where he shot Greedo first? He absolutely shot first, okay?
Yeah.
I hate the way that it was edited.
I also think that there's an element of the fact that on the flip side of the spectrum, you will tend to see just a flash of vulnerability or a flash of something human in a morally grey character, which you might not see in just a purely evil character. I'm actually going to use my own writing as an example, which is Sperrin and de Giles in book two of the Hamartia cycle.
If you try and say de Giles is morally grey, I'm not going to believe you.
De Giles is not morally grey. De Giles is just full-on bad person. He's definitely got his reasons for doing what he's doing, but they're not good reasons. He's not morally grey in the least.
De Giles is so dark that the colour black is standing there going, damn, that is some serious darkness.
Yeah, de Giles is a bad person. I think he's one of the few truly evil characters I've ever written, where he is just completely evil. There's no nuance to him at all. He is just evil. He really just does enjoy hurting people. He's an actual masochist. No, he's not a masochist. He's an actual sadist, sorry. Whereas Sverin, and Sverin, again, not really a good guy. But Sverin has this nuance to him in that you see a tiny bit of that vulnerability coming through, and you start to understand why he's acting in the way that he acts and what's happening underneath it all. And so he does have his vulnerable moments, and he does have his soft moments, and he does have his almost human moments as well, which you're meant, you know, can elicit a sense of pity in the same way that, you know, Shylock had as well, which is why I would argue that Shylock is a tiny bit morally grey, even if he's really on the end of the the bad scale. There's just a tiny bit of that gradient there, and it's the same with Sverin, and you just compare the two of them and you see immediately that there is just that still that touch of humanity in Sverin, which is ultimately also what lets him get away with a lot of what he does before ultimately even his best friend is like, dude, bit far now,
too much. I mean, that's the thing with morally grey characters. The final really big pro is they help drive the plot and they take it in interesting directions that you might not have thought of, because you don't know what they're going to do next. Quite often because they haven't decided what they're going to do next.
Absolutely.
So they're great characters for lighting fires and adding extra stresses to an already complicated situation. If you want to avoid a completely bog-standard linear plot, then you put in a morally grey character, because I guarantee it will go some interesting places.
Of course, there are some cons to writing a morally grey character as well.
Definitely.
Which is that, you know, we talked right at the beginning about how morally grey characters are relatable, but if you don't write them correctly, they can become totally unrelatable.
Yeah, definitely. You don't want somebody who is so chaotic that nobody knows what they're doing at all, so that you can't follow them, I think, is a big one. And, you know, if they seem too spurious, it's kind of like, I actually kind of like Iago from Othello, but Iago seems to me much more of a personification of Othello's own insecurities than an actual person in many ways, simply because the things he does, sometimes he does just because he can do them, just because they're the most destructive. Yeah. And you start to lose a reader at that point if you put too much of that on page.
Yeah, I think you're right. Ultimately, there needs to be the sense of cause and effect, which is that something needs to be gained from each of those actions. With Iago, as you say, that there is this sense that he might be, you know, the personification of Othello's self-doubt and negative traits. I always read it as Iago being completely in love with Othello and being kind of furious about it as well. And so it's an internalized hatred, it's an internalized homophobia. It's the fact that he's racist, but also at the same time desires Othello, and he can't tell what he wants because he knows he'll never get it, so he's just kind of wants to make everything and everyone hurt as much as he does, and he's not actually planning anything. It's not that he's got this master plan necessarily, it's just that he just is trying to be cause pain or lashing out, and at times that's more or less, because at times actually suddenly he's no longer in the mood to cause pain, he might be in the mood for comfort instead. It depends really how he's played, to be honest, and how he's read.
Ultimately he just become, you know, Iago works in the function he's got, but if you took a character like that and allowed it free rein, then you've just got a chaotic character. You haven't got chaotic good or chaotic bad, you've just got chaos. And that sort of character will trample through your carefully planned plot and structure and make a big mess, and not in a good way, not in a, oh my god, I didn't think of putting the book in this direction, just in a case of, oh god, nothing fits together and nothing makes sense anymore way.
It makes me think of Q from Star Trek. Q is completely chaotic, and he's a very morally grey character. What does he want at any given time? Who knows? I don't think even Q knows. Certainly the rest of the Q don't know. But there's the sense of Q's great, but I think that there would be this great struggle if he was actually in the series every single episode the whole time.
Yeah, it wouldn't work. I mean, largely, he's driven by a need to not be bored. Because even the other Q are kind of like, what are you doing, you weird deviant kind of thing. They're like, why are you bothering with these lower life forms? And it is because he's bored. Because if you have all the power in the universe, ultimately, then what are you going to do?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it is the chaotic thing. Okay, a big con with morally grey characters is there has to be a line. And what I mean is there has to be a line that they won't cross. And you don't necessarily have to spell it out as in they won't do this. But there are things that you can have a character do that there will be no coming back from. If you have a character that people kind of like and find relatable, even if they do a few bad things, if it's suddenly revealed that they're a child molester or a rapist, or, you know, they start beating up their elderly mother, then guess what? Your reader doesn't want to read the rest of that book. Yeah. That's it. You've lost them.
Drowning puppies.
And some people... Yeah, drowning puppies, live boiling kittens, things like that. So anything really shit like that, you kind of need to know where the line is, I think. And it's just a... You have to remember that everyone has different hard limits as well. So while someone might be okay with someone... Let's say your morally grey character is with someone who is absolutely in love with them, and because they are who they are and they're, you know, they're part chaos by nature, they go off and sleep with somebody else and really hurt this other person, break their heart. For some people, that would be a deal breaker. That would be, I'm putting the book down, I'm not finishing it. And you have to be okay with that, because that means you're then not writing for that reader anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. An example of this, and I'm sorry to bring it up, but Locke Lamora, in the first book, Locke and the Gentleman Bastards are definitely grey.
I was going to say they're all morally grey. I'm surprised they haven't come up before.
I was trying to hold myself back, Jules. But yeah, they're all morally grey characters, and yet they kind of have a limit, which is right at the beginning that you have Locke, who's basically attending what is essentially like these gladiator sort of esque fights. Prisoners are being killed, fed to monsters, and stuff like that. And Locke is like, I accept that this is just an ordinary part of the world. That doesn't mean I have to sit and watch and enjoy it. He kind of just keeps his back to it. And then similarly, there's a situation, and I'm not going to give too many spoilers in case anyone wants to go and read it, but there's a situation where Locke suddenly finds out that there's a large number of people who are in danger. And despite the fact that it would be extremely inconvenient and a massive risk, and he doesn't owe these people anything, particularly because they might have poisoned him, he basically goes, well, shit, I can't actually just stand by and let that happen, so I've got to go and help. How that turns out, I shall leave for you guys to find out. But there is the sense of actually, at the end of the day, when a choice is given, this is a character who ultimately, despite the fact they'll very happily, you know, completely destroy a very, you know, steal a rich person's money and you know, take half of their wealth, does actually at the same time try to kind of keep a relative sense of balance. Like he puts a guy into a serious situation, gives him a handful of money and goes, flee the country right now, because otherwise you're dead. Off you go. So yeah, he's put this guy into a terrible position where he's going to have to leave the only, you know, land he's ever known, potentially a family and all that stuff. But it's rather than just leaving him to be, you know, hung, drawn and quartered. So, and I think that is ultimately kind of the saving grace of Locke Lamora as a character, which is that if Locke was just 100%, I'm down to just letting lots of people die, I'm down to just kind of doing what I need to do and letting other people die as a consequence of it, without much thought about it, or I'm down with committing rape or stuff like that, he would no longer be an enjoyable character.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, final really big con with morally grey characters. It's actually really difficult to fully resolve their character arcs because their desires and motivations shift. You have to be really careful about how you prepare and foreshadow for your audience in order for them to feel that when you get to the end of the story, the end of the series or whatever, that you feel that something's been resolved for them. Unless they're, you know, kind of a very sort of second, third tier character, in which case you can leave it open, I suppose. But if they are one of the main cast, you need to do something so that people feel that the story has come to a rest for that character as well, I think.
I think you're right. Absolutely. And it is tricky. And I think that there's the potential to cop out with it a little bit as well.
Yeah, it's kind of like, oh, I don't really want to pin this character down. And I can completely understand that. I suppose the thing is that morally grey characters, their character development tends to happen slower over the course of a book or a series. And it tends to not necessarily follow the same logic as the character development for, say, a more good or bad oriented character as well. Again, it's the chaotic nature, isn't it?
It's also about understanding what motivates them. I think it's a little bit too easy to say they're motivated by themselves, because ultimately different things within ourselves motivate us, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So, if you want to write a morally grey character, you might want to consider the following things. I'm doing this from memory because for some reason I gave you my notes.
That's fine. You read one and then I'll read one and we'll see what happens, okay?
Why would I do such a thing? Anyway, as we've said before, you need to know where the character's line is. Because you need to know whether that character is morally grey with a slight more bias towards the dark side, as it were, or morally grey, but there are definitely places where they won't go. And again, you don't need to spell them out. You don't need to be like, I'm Batman and I won't kill people kind of thing, which, by the way, is actually a really stupid thing for Batman to do.
Go into the nuance of that later.
We'll go into the nuance of that later. But it's kind of, you know, as a commonsensical thing for a very practical character, that's just a stupid line to have.
You don't need to kill everybody, but maybe, I don't know, lobotomize the Joker. Maybe.
You know. Because as he makes the point of saying, anyway, sorry, we've done this before. I'm coming back. Know where the line is. And, you know, maybe save things like rape and child molestation, if you absolutely have to have them, save them for your bad characters, because your readers are not going to forgive that.
Though occasionally your readers will apparently just forgive child murder, and I'm looking at you, Clegane, from Game of Thrones.
I was always kind of like, I can't help the fact that I'm starting to like him, but he did stab the butcher boy. And we don't know how many others. And I get he saw it as just, well, this is my job kind of thing. But also it's kind of like, that's a child.
And it's the same with Jamie. Everyone's like, I kind of like Jamie now. But he threw Bran out of a window, didn't he?
So I don't know. That show was very good at playing with our sympathies. Definitely. Other things you might want to consider if you are writing
if you have your morally grey character as your main character, you can't, you know, their decisions can't just appear entirely spontaneous or purposeless to the reader. You know, there does have to be this, particularly if it's the main character, there has to be this line of thought, this cause and effect, which is understandable and not necessarily predictable, but you need to be able to follow it. You need to be able to say logically, okay, I can see how you went from that to that. Good example of that is Kaz Brekker from Six of Crows. Yeah. Verily,
verily, he is a morally grey character. He is grey of hue. For so I say unto thee.
I summoned Shakespeare accidentally. He came to join to give his opinion. What I was trying to say is that he is a very morally grey character. But you can kind of... First of all, his line is very easily shown. We see that he does indeed have a line, though he himself pretends that he doesn't. And that's actually something that's quite cleverly done, is that he gives the impression that he doesn't. He says that he doesn't. And I think one of the main, you know, components of Kaz is the idea that actually most things, if in the right circumstances, people are capable of, basically. That's an important part of his character. But the point is that every time he does do something which feels deplorable, there is this, we can understand exactly what is motivating him to do that, why he's doing that, or why he's gone to this, that, or the other. And I think that makes ultimately a big difference.
Yeah, definitely.
If they're about to fuck someone over, they ought to be seen to wrestle a bit with their conscience before doing it anyway.
That's a tricky one. You don't want them agonising and hand-wringing because they're not hand-wringing sort of characters. But there should be, as Madeline has said before, that little glimpse of humanity, that little twinge of, I know exactly what this is going to do to somebody, and this is not a good thing to do. I'm going to do it anyway because it serves my agenda, but this is a bad thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, Kaz Brekker, there's a really great example of that in Six of Crows, where he breaks someone's arm and Mateus goes, was that really necessary? And Kaz goes, no. And internally Kaz is going, yes, it was. Because Kaz is a 17-year-old kid who's just arrived in prison with a limp. He basically needed to assert a certain amount of authority, because otherwise he would have been in a lot of trouble and they would have all been in a lot of difficulty. He needed to assert authority to a sense of, you know, I have to kind of make sure that you leave us alone.
It's the use of expedient cruelty to make sure the stories about you you want told get
exactly.
told.
And that's something that Kaz Brekker does a lot. And we know also for a fact that he does feel certain amount of, not necessarily guilt, but he recognises some of the nasty things he's done. And that's explored through his relationship with Inej, because Inej is constantly trying to find some good in Kaz. And Kaz is constantly fighting against that, saying, there is no good in me. To the extent that he's able to identify the things that he knows that she won't find good. And there's this, it's very subtly done, Leah Bardugo does do this very subtly, whereby we understand then that Kaz is projecting something onto himself there. He doesn't think of himself as a good person. He's able to identify the bad things he's done in the past. And the way that he acts, you know, in certain kindnesses and things like that, shows that inside, despite what he tells himself, he does have, you know, his own kind of moral compass, and he does recognise things when he's gone too far, and he does potentially not regret them, but he does think on them, and he does recognise them for bad deeds.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, a final, I think, thing that you should think of if you are writing a morally grey character is that you need to start preparing your reader for how things are going to resolve, and you do need to work harder at making the resolution actually happen, because obviously their character development will not follow a straight path, and it won't necessarily be a cause and effect thing. It'll do this weird spaghetti map type thing. So you need to be very careful that you are seeding through some foreshadowing through there. It's really poor form to cheat the reader by pulling a bait and switch at the 11th hour in the book. You might have them going, oh, well, actually, they could lean more towards good, they could lean more towards bad. They need to lean one way or another if they're a main character. And you can keep the reader guessing right up until the end, as long as the reader can then look back and say, actually, looking back at it, because they did the X, Y, and Z, I can see why they went in that direction.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree. And I think that's something that is achieved in Loch Lomora, for instance. It's particularly interesting because the book starts with Locke murdering like several children inadvertently.
Weirdly, you don't really feel like he's a bad guy at that point. So, I mean, that's quite a trick. Obviously, Loch Lomora, the series, hasn't finished yet. But you do get to the end of each book still feeling that he is leaning in one direction or another.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I suppose the good thing with the series and having a morally grey character is you can have book one and it's kind of like, oh, they're still leaning slightly towards the light, and then something bad happens in book two and it's kind of like, oh no, this is all going to go very dark for me, kind of thing.
I do feel like Locke actually, as time goes on, leans more and more toward the side of the good, because I think he's more and more tired of the world. Like, there's just this one bit in book two where they witness two lovers having, not two lovers, two courters having a quarrel over a woman. And they're having a duel, and Locke watches it and just goes, I must be getting old because this just hurts my heart, kind of thing. Like, he just finds it really exhausting, the whole sort of, actually, this was so totally unnecessary. And it would have been something that in book one, he would have kind of been like, yeah, that's the way life is. And now there's this, this sense of, I'm really tired. Really tired of all of this. And also it's another thing is that at one point he keeps witnessing these very inhumane kind of games, which again in the first one he just kind of ignored the things that he didn't want to see, whereas in this one he purposefully goes back to witness them and then tries to do something about them, because he really does find them completely disgusting. So there's this, and you can understand the way that this growth has happened. He's still very morally grey, because obviously he's still a massive thief. And Jean is morally grey, because Jean will very easily kill a bunch of people, but he won't kill a sleeping man, you know, and he won't kill children or stuff like that. He will beat children up, though, to teach them a lesson.
They had that coming.
They did, yes.
Right, I'm going to steer you away from Loch Lomora now. Because otherwise it'll turn into the Loch Lomora episode. We've definitely done one of those. So, just to finish up, let's look at some of our favourite morally grey characters, and we can look at some of the ones in our own work as well. Obviously, we talked about Kaz Brekker. We've talked about Loch Lomora and Jean.
I love that you have to assert that, like, our favourite morally grey characters. Well, let me talk to you about
them. Except the ones we've talked about at length already. I'll mention one or two others. I've mentioned Trail of Lightning by Rebecca Roanhorse before. It's sort of a dystopian, post-apocalyptic retelling of certain Native American legends. And you've got the coyote god, Mayi, turns up. And Mayi is very, very much a morally grey character. He is constantly putting the main characters in horrible danger. And then he'll suddenly come up with this unexpected piece of wisdom that makes everything slot into place for them. So I loved his character. I wasn't actually that invested in the book until a third of the way through when he showed up. And it was kind of like, oh my god, this is like crack kind of thing. Not that I've ever had crack, but, you know, assuming... so that's how you get me on board.
Morally grey characters. I've got to say Robin Hood. But then Robin Hood, I've always been a massive sucker for Robin Hood in general, in any incarnation or any version. Especially if they're a fox.
it is a bit sort of witch incarnation.
Yeah. I'd also say... And I'm not sure whether he would be counted as a morally grey character, but Geralt from The Witcher.
I wouldn't put him as morally grey.
Well, the thing is, I would put him as morally grey in terms of the games, because he can go either way. The point is that as a stock character, he can go either way, because obviously you've got to have the choice about what he ultimately does, whether he accepts jobs, whether he will sell a person or leave a person to die, or whether he'll go and save them, or stuff like that. Which means that at his core, there has to be morally grey, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to make those choices. I haven't convinced you, have I?
Yeah, maybe. No, not really. But then I haven't played the games, in fairness. And, you know, that's not so much the character, that's the gamer who is morally grey. Yeah.
You hear that, gamers?
Depending. I mean, maybe you're somebody who always like wants to play the hero, and that's fine. Or maybe you're the guy who's like, always like, no, fuck everybody else, I'm going to do what serves me.
But I think initially, Geralt is morally grey, because he's just doing it for money. He doesn't really get invested.
I don't think that doesn't make him morally grey, in my opinion. I think that makes him jaded.
Okay.
That's very much the state that Gregory starts off in. And I wouldn't say Gregory was morally grey either. They've both clearly got a code that, that's kind of got a bit tarnished. And when they finally start letting other characters in, they become very much in the direction of good.
Yeah. Okay. All right. I will concede to that.
But you have a point about the games. Yennefer, on the other hand, is very morally grey. Definitely. And I really liked her. I mean, I'm going from the series here, but I really liked her as a character. I know she annoyed you, but from the start, I thought she was brilliant. I loved the fact that she didn't jump one way or the other, and she did everything that's to suit herself. It's so rare to see a female character do that.
Well, as I said, Yennefer as a character was always someone who I initially don't really like at the beginning, but as her journey continues and she develops, I tend to like her a little bit more. So in later stories, I tend to find her more endearing and more interesting. It was just to begin with, I never really enjoyed her straight away. But yeah, I can totally understand the appeal in that way. I can't. My head has gone completely blank now for other morally grey characters.
Well, I've got my own morally grey characters. Three definite ones. Obviously, no one's really met Melanie Beckett yet, but she's definitely morally grey.
Yes, she certainly is.
I don't want to give anything away as to what... I know what happens in her story arc now. I've worked out the final major bits, like, dropped into place. So I'll finish writing those and that'll be great. But yeah, she's never a white hat, put it that way.
No, absolutely not.
Aunt Mary.
Yeah, very morally grey.
Cranford. Typical mentor type as well. You always feel she's serving her own agenda because she is serving her own agenda as well. It just happens that she is doing what she thinks is right. It just might not be what everyone else thinks is right. And she does try and help because her backstory is that she has meddled in things before. So she tries not to meddle, but it's quite a difficult habit for her to break.
Yeah, she's a natural meddler.
The most morally grey, I think, is probably Edie Gillis, who is the witch who dies during the second book. And it's not so much she's self-serving, it's just her perspective of what the world should be like is different to what Em's perspective of it should be like. Edie Gillis has no naivety, no innocence or anything left, which, considering she's well over 100 years old at that point, isn't really that surprising. Yeah. But obviously that comes as a massive culture shock to Em, who's kind of been in a case of, I've been manipulated by my actual mentor slightly, and I feel quite bitter about it. And this woman comes along and makes her look like a saint by comparison.
Yeah.
And still act in a way that ultimately is right, but goes about it in a way that is probably very, very wrong.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Obviously, within my own work, I have a few morally grey characters as well. Within the Hamartia cycle, it could be argued that Embar Regan is a little bit morally grey. He's part of the rebellion. He is serving a purpose and he does care about his friends. But ultimately, he's everything he's doing is kind of for himself. And because of the very nature of what he is, he's quite chaotic and he's very self-serving.
Yeah.
Weirdly enough, I think someone once described Zachary as morally grey, and Zachary isn't actually morally grey. He's very moral, it's just his morals are a little bit screwed up.
No, see, I would say Zachary was kind of, he leans more towards absolutism. Yeah. As in, when he believes something, he throws himself into it, heart, soul, and dragon form. And it's not always the right decision.
Very much it is not always the right decision, but my God, is he going to stick to it? Within Kestrel as well, there are several morally grey characters, but I'm not actually going to go into those just yet, because, yeah, I'd like to just keep hold of that one, if that's okay.
Yeah, definitely. I'm sure I'll have a few more crop up. Weirdly, I kind of feel like I don't mean the actual Geoffrey Chaucer, because no one really knows what he was like. But my incarnation of Chaucer is a tiny bit in that direction.
So glad you said that, because I was thinking it, and then I thought, no, she's going to say I'm wrong.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? He's not really just serving himself. He's serving his idea of what he thinks is right and appropriate. And he's not... It's not beyond him to kind of manipulate Gregory into doing what he wants him to do.
Yeah, absolutely. I do feel like Chaucer in general would have been a morally grey character.
Yeah, I think so. And the more I read about him, the more I find out about him, the more you build a picture of... And it is very difficult because, my God, if I'd been dead 600 years and someone was trying to work out what I was like from what I've written, I don't think they'd come up with a picture of me as a person. Or at least I really hope they wouldn't. Please do not judge me by my works. When we're doing that with Chaucer, it's kind of like we're assuming that the person who created this was actually really saying these things. He wasn't just like being a fantasist. But there are other things that kind of don't add up, and you think, well, this was clearly a complicated and fully realised human being who was completely capable of acting within his own interests and appears to have just found humanity and human folly highly entertaining. And that sort of being able to take a step back and laugh at both the world and people and yet still be enraged by its injustices, to me, sort of smacks of a genuinely morally grey person just generally, particularly since the morals would have been set by the church at the time and he really didn't get on with the church.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think you're completely right. I also think that we've run out of time.
We have come to the end of our episode on morally grey characters.
Before we go, it is time for our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week, and this week, Jules, you have got one for us.
Yes, it's the Netflix series Lock and Key.
You sounded so uncertain.
Yes. Sorry, my voice is going to be a bit scrapey. It's the Netflix series Lock and Key. Could we please get to the end of the episode?
I'm so sorry, I'm trying.
Yes, my recommendation this week is the Netflix series Lock and Key, which is based on the books by Joe Hill and Gabriel, I want to say Velasquez, but I could be wrong there. It's Joe Hill, I remember, because he's Stephen King's son. It's not as horrific as the books, I've been told, which I haven't read yet. And it sort of caters more towards whimsy. It's got a very Lovecraftian feel. And it follows this family who, after the tragic murder of their father, go back to his family home, which he wouldn't talk about because he hated it. Mm-hmm. And they find themselves in this huge mansion in a town that in the books is actually called Lovecraft. And strange things start to happen. They start to find magical keys that can do strange things in the house. I really don't want to spoil it by saying exactly what happens, but let's just say the keys are an amazing analogy for all the dark little places and fantasies we keep in our heads. Yeah. And they can start off very, very innocently. If you think about being a child and imagining yourself with a superpower, you probably weren't thinking about blowing up the universe kind of thing, or not in any real sense of understanding what that would mean. But then that same... If you imagine sort of then applying that same ability to imagine a superpower for yourself as an adult, it takes on a much darker hue. And I love the way they've done that kind of metaphor with the whole thing. And it is a lot of fun as well.
Yeah. I've only watched the first episode so far, but it's definitely intriguing, and it's had its dark moments already, so very much worth a watch, and you can find it on Netflix. Well, do let us know who your favourite morally grey characters are, whether you agree with our assessment or whether you disagree with our assessment. We would also like to ask if you have any favourite quotes or favourite moments from Dissecting Dragons that have just stuck in your mind, or particularly favourite episodes. Do let us know, as we would like to start gathering these things up for to be announced later.
A future project.
A future project indeed. And on that note, guys, we'll say thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you guys next week.
Yeah, thanks and goodbye.
Bye!
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders. Or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.